ready to kick this thing off. Yeah. Can I kick it off? Yeah. 1, 2, 3, boom.
Everybody, welcome back to World History Class with Mr. Lutz, where today we take a look at what is known as decolonization, meaning the end of empire, really, throughout all of the world. So this episode is going to jump around a bit throughout several different nations in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, but it's always going to keep a tight focus on the key concepts. It'd be a good idea to visit my blog or to check out the episode description, because I will have the key concepts listed for you to check out, so that you can keep focus regarding what you should understand when all is said and done with this episode. So, without further ado, let's begin. The first country we're going to address with our key concept connections is going to be China. So the People's Republic of China had emerged in 1949 with the victory of the communists over the nationalists, who had fled across the Taiwan Strait to the island of Taiwan, where they established the Republic of China, which is still in existence today. Gone were the days of imperialist interference in China, as Mao forged a path for the People's Republic that would set out to replicate the industrial successes of Stalin's Soviet Union. Most newly independent countries in South, East, and Southeast Asia, with the exception of India and Japan, would adopt some type of an authoritarian government, and China was not to be an additional exception to this rule. Mao's desire, above all else in the initial years, was to industrialize China as rapidly as possible, and this was to begin with his first five-year plan, taking a page out of Stalin's book with that title, but he was to specifically call this one the Great Leap Forward. This plan was to thrust China into superpower status with ideas that were to modernize the nation in 15 years. All land was taken by the government and redistributed to the peasantry, who operated the land on behalf of the state in what were called communes. These communes were characterized by collective labor in all facets of life, whether it was farming, manufacturing, childcare, you name it. Families were separated from one another, and women were empowered in a way they had never been before in China. They were no longer forced into marriages. They could divorce, and the practice of foot binding was finally ended. All metal goods in the homes of peasants were taken and melted down in backyard furnaces, where families were asked to produce steel for the state and had quotas that were to be met. There was to be no selling of agricultural surplus, as all food was to be collected and redistributed by the government. This plan, to say the least, was an epic failure. Steel produced in backyard furnaces was of poor quality and deemed useless. Workers were not adequately incentivized to work hard in this new type of system, and thus their productivity rates declined. Crops were grown too densely together, and this sucked vital nutrients out of the soil, which furthered the decline in agricultural output. Overseers who were either fearful of reprimand or eager to please inflated their statistics on productivity. But this just led to the government taking more food from the peasants and shipping it off to the cities than they should have. Peasants starved. The Yellow River, unfortunately and coincidentally, flooded during this time, leading to further crop failures. When all was said and done, approximately 23 to 46 million Chinese died as a result of the plans devised in the Great Leap Forward. Mao, fearing for his political authority and legacy as a result of the Great Leap Forward, pushed ahead with the Cultural Revolution in 1966, hoping to maintain the revolutionary fervor in China. Emboldened by Mao and the words published in his Little Red Book, students known as Red Guards were tasked with the duty of destroying the Four Olds by targeting those who were deemed to represent foreign, bourgeois, or counter-revolutionary beliefs. Communist Party members, teachers, intellectuals, and other groups were particularly persecuted and humiliated or beaten, or sent to re-education camps in the countryside, or killed. One Communist Party member who was cast into the countryside during this time was Deng Xiaoping. But after Mao's death in 1976, he would emerge as his successor. Deng would go on to economically transform China, but he stopped short of change when it came to the political culture of the state. He was eager to allow China the opportunity to re-enter the global economy and its citizens to earn a profit by implementing free market economic policies. New special economic zones, or SEZs, were set up in certain cities throughout China that were open to foreign investors who were able to establish factories there. Communes were abolished and peasants now leased their land and were able to sell their agricultural surplus for a profit on the open market. Workers were now incentivized to be more productive, and they could purchase new consumer goods being manufactured in Chinese factories. Students were also able to study abroad, where they began to learn of Western values like democracy. And when they returned home, they began to advocate for political reforms, seeing as now they began to experience economic stability. Students occupied Tiananmen Square for weeks and demanded their government reform itself, proposing an alternative to their political order. Deng refused to budge and did not trust student movements, given his experiences with the Cultural Revolution. As a result, he ordered the Chinese military to move in on Tiananmen Square with tanks and through the use of force. Several hundred, if not over 1,000, were killed in this crackdown, which the Chinese do very little to acknowledge and actively repress the memory of this event. Since then, China's economy has continued to grow at a rate that will make it the world's largest economy in the very near future. However, it has done little, if anything, to politically reform itself. So now we turn our attention to India after World War II, where an exhausted and depleted Great Britain wrestled with the question of Indian independence. Winston Churchill, who was the wartime prime minister, had stood opposed to any plan that would separate India from the British Empire. But once his term ended, the question of independence gained much more relevance. As the topic of independence began to be negotiated, the question of partition, or a separation of India into a separate Muslim and Hindu state, loomed large over the conversation. The Indian National Congress had been the most influential group in advocating for Indian interests since the late 19th century, but they had begun to face opposition in the form of the Muslim League regarding their plans for India's future. The INC had been led by Mohandas Gandhi and Jawaharlal Nehru, and since the conclusion of World War I, they had called for self-rule, meaning independence for India. The Muslim League, led by Muhammad Ali Jinnah, advocated for the same thing, but they feared for their people who were minorities in a state that was dominated by Hindus. What Jinnah and the Muslim League desired was not only a break from Great Britain, but also the establishment of an independent nation that would look after the interests of the Muslims of South Asia. Violence ensued between Muslims and Hindus as these terms were being debated, which only furthered the efforts of the Muslim League and the calls for two separate independent nations. Ultimately, by August of 1947, Great Britain withdrew itself from India, and the nation broke into the states of India and Pakistan, for the Hindus and the Muslims, respectively. The action resulted in the population transfers of approximately 10 million Hindus and Muslims, and potentially the deaths of up to 1 million individuals caught up in the violence that ensued. The first leader of an independent India was Nehru, and he opted to send India into a course called non-alignment, refusing to align his nation with either the United States or the Soviet Union in the emerging Cold War. Other nations would also adopt the strategy of non-alignment, and leaders from throughout Africa and Asia met at the Bandung Conference in Indonesia to discuss how newly independent nations could band together to opt for a third course, neither allied with USA or USSR, that would help them to develop their nations newly freed from the bonds of colonialism. However, this was easier said than done, as support from either of the two global superpowers proved too attractive for some member nations of the non-alignment movement to avoid. India desired to modernize itself politically by establishing the largest democracy in the world. Socially speaking, it began to address the inequities that had pervaded for most of its history through the caste system, and agriculturally, it began an experiment known as the Green Revolution. Its status as a democracy in Asia during the 20th century certainly makes it unique, and this legacy is owed to Nehru and the founders of the nation. It was also Nehru's government that drew up the Constitution of 1950, which gave the quote-unquote scheduled castes, who we have called the untouchables in past units, equality of opportunity and established a plan known as the reservation system, which reserved a particular number of spots for the scheduled castes in educational and governmental positions. This system has not been without problems, which reflects the natural messiness of democratic governance in the nation with the second largest population in the world. This massive population required the adoption also of advanced techniques in farming to help feed so many people, and this became known as the Green Revolution. The Green Revolution was defined by the use of high-yielding varieties of seeds that required lots of fertilizers and pesticides that would help protect and ensure they could be as productive as possible. Agricultural output did rise in India, helping to ensure wealthy farmers became richer. But the purchasing of more and more pesticides and fertilizer drove peasants further into debt and forced them to use these seeds that don't grow well otherwise. India has since maintained its democratic governance, and it has continued to face problems relating to overpopulation, poverty, and religious division among Hindu, Muslims, and Sikhs, as well, who have also advocated and fought at times for their own independent nation. South Asians have continued to migrate to Britain during the 20th and 21st centuries due to close relations between Britain and Punjabis who served in their military. Individuals throughout India have gone to Britain seeking out better opportunities, and somewhat more recently, many from South Asia have fled civil war between Pakistan and what is now Bangladesh in the 1970s, heading to Britain. Now, when we last discussed the Arab world, we had discussed its partitioning between the British and the French, who created territories that were known as mandates, which were to be administered on behalf of the League of Nations. And this was done in spite of their promising these lands to develop as independent Arab states, while also supporting the Zionist movement for a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Jews had continued migrating to Palestine during the early 20th century, which began to draw concerns among the Palestinian Arabs who believed this was to be the land for their eventual independent nation. The British began to restrict Jewish migration into the region, but the question came to a head after the conclusion of World War II. The British and the French began to withdraw from the Arab world almost immediately following the Second World War, and Arab nations began to establish themselves as independent. However, the millions of Jews who had been victimized by and were now survivors of the Holocaust were now faced with the prospect of a future characterized by uncertainty, seeing as their livelihoods and families had been destroyed. Sympathies for the plight of the Jews grew in the international community, and a groundswell of support grew for a Jewish homeland in Palestine, which stood as a direct contradiction to a nation being established in Palestine for its Arab population. Jews, frustrated by continued immigration restrictions to Palestine and inaction towards their homeland being established, began to use violence against the British to force their hand. By 1947, the British pulled out of the region and turned the debate regarding Palestine over to the newly established United Nations. That same year, the UN announced its plan to partition Palestine into two states, one Jewish and one Arab. Soon after, in 1948, the Jews declared the independent state of Israel established. And this led to almost immediate conflict with the Arab world in fits and starts from 1948 to 1949, again in 1956, 1967, 1973, and 1982. Throughout these conflicts, the Israelis were able to defend themselves, but they were also able to expand their territory throughout the region, especially into Palestinian territories, which led to the migrations of Palestinians to other Arab states in the region, particularly Jordan. Frustrated by the inability of a pan-Arab movement to check the Israelis in the region, if not destroy their state entirely, it led to a movement known as the Intifada, or Uprising, which was characterized by Palestinian riots, strikes, protests, and terrorist attacks against the State of Israel. The Israelis responded to these actions with increased military presence in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, which were the two Palestinian territories. The Israelis also took direct military action in response to these attacks, and they constructed a border wall that was meant to prevent suspected Palestinian terrorists from entering Israeli territory. As Israel set its roots in the Arab world, a movement uniting Arab nations across the region emerged, which set out to destroy the newly established state and set the region on a path towards modernity. Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq had unsuccessfully attempted to destroy Israel in a war fought immediately after its establishment in 1948 and 1949. But frustrated with corruption and Western influence in the Egyptian government, Abdel Gamal Nasser, along with fellow officers in the Egyptian army, launched a coup d'etat in 1952, and in 2 years' time he took control of Egypt. The first issue on Nasser's agenda was to modernize Egypt and strengthen it by implementing social and economic reforms. One of Nasser's major projects within Egypt was to create a more stable power source by constructing a hydroelectric dam along the Nile River. The United States offered loans to support this project in an attempt to win Nasser's allegiance, as he had previously been committed to the Non-Alignment Movement, and he had even attended the Bandung Conference along with Nehru of India. However, Nasser refused the United States' offer and instead began siding with the Soviet Union. To finance construction of the dam, Nasser took the bold step of seizing control of the Suez Canal from the British in 1956, leading to what became known as the Suez Crisis. Britain, France, and Israel all invaded parts of Egypt, and the world reacted harshly against this invasive action by Western forces, because it seemed to echo similar actions of the imperial past. Eventually, after the protests particularly of the United States, Britain, France, and Israel withdrew from the region, and the Suez Canal was formally nationalized by the Egyptian government. With Egypt on a path towards modernity, Nasser took the next step of uniting the Arab world and working together towards common goals, and this movement was known as Pan-Arabism. His nation joined with Syria for some time to form the United Arab Republic. However, this was a better idea more than anything else, and soon it failed. This was in due part to Egypt's dominance over the Union and the resentment on behalf of the Syrians towards their Egyptian government. Nasser faced increasing problems in the ensuing years, most notably the disastrous Six-Day War fought against Israel in 1967, which resulted in a significant defeat for Arab forces and the loss of territory to the Israelis. Nasser died by 1970, and his successor, Anwar Sadat, attempted to establish peace with Israel in what became known as the Camp David Accords. This led to Egypt recognizing Israel as a state in exchange for territories returned to Egypt on behalf of the Israelis that had been lost in previous wars. This conciliatory stance towards Israel led to rejections from other Arab nations, doing more damage to Pan-Arabism, and it eventually resulted in a Sadat's assassination that was orchestrated by Egyptian Arabs. Socialism and Arab nationalism had not solved the problems of the Middle East, and this led to some proposing religion as another potential solution. The Middle East had attempted to assert itself as they became decolonized, but the legacies of colonialism had not seemed to truly fade into the past. Foreign powers, notably the United States and the Soviet Union, had still competed for influence in the region, and there seemed to be an atmosphere reflecting increasing Arab decline. Some began to blame the issues on a rejection of Islamic traditions and thus called for a return to the ways of the past. This movement is usually termed Islamism, and it was characterized by a feeling that traditional ways were under a continued assault on behalf of foreign forces, and those attacks needed to be dealt with by any means necessary, including the use of violence. We'll discuss how this Islamist movement worked particularly outside of the Arab world and in Iran during the 20th century. Iran had been struggling to deal with this foreign, particularly British and American, influence in its politics during the first half of the 20th century. During this time, British Petroleum, what we know today as BP, had controlled much of the oil that was present in Iran. However, in the early 1950s, Mohammad Mossadegh had come to power as Prime Minister of Iran based on his actions of nationalizing Iranian oil and effectively driving BP out of the region. The British had a desire to dispose of Mossadegh, but they were unable to do it on their own, so they turned to the United States for help. In 1953, the United States helped engineer a coup d'etat of Mossadegh, and they brought Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi to power. The Shah worked hand-in-hand with the United States, allowing for American business involvement in the region, especially the oil industry, while the Americans ensured he would help support the fight against the spread of Soviet communism. Pahlavi's regime was characterized by political repression, secularism, and poor business conditions for Iranians, as foreign powers, not only the United States, made it difficult for Iranian businesses to effectively compete. A revolutionary movement swept the country in the late 1970s, and eventually the Shah fled to the United States in 1979. His government was replaced by an Islamist government led by a man named Ayatollah Khomeini. Khomeini's strategy was to help Iran achieve autonomy, and it looked somewhat different than what we've seen with other nations that we've discussed so far. Like China under Mao, the Iranian government used anti-Western rhetoric as a way to appeal to their people, who had grown angry after their negative experiences with foreign involvement. The Iranians even held workers from the U.S. embassy in Tehran hostage for over a year, while also shutting down U.S. military bases and businesses in their country. The new Iranian government ushered in an era where religious doctrine would influence the legal system, public behavior, and all facets of Iranian life. Universities were cleared of Western and secular influence, while women were ordered to dress in a more religiously conservative fashion. The culture and politics of the West had been rejected, but not as a communist critique this time around. It took the form in Iran of religious fundamentalism and a call to return to the supposed traditions of the past. Many of the trends that we've seen in East and South Asia, as well as the Middle East, appeared throughout Africa as well. These include both negotiated and armed struggle for independence, the emergence of transnational movements to unify people across borders, and flirtations with socialist or communist models of governance. Ghana became the first sub-Saharan country that was able to gain independence following its experiences with colonialism. By the early 1950s, Kwame Nkrumah had emerged as the leader of a political party that was growing in popularity throughout Ghana. His party grew in popularity thanks to his methods of direct action, such as strikes and protests that were intended to help deliver independence from Britain. Independence was negotiated with the British for several years, and by 1957, the independent nation of Ghana was formed. Nkrumah intended to use his position as leader of one of the first freed countries in Africa as a springboard that would help deliver independence to other peoples throughout Africa. Many African nations earned their independence shortly after Ghana, and in 1958, Nkrumah held a conference of intended African states, which was the beginning of a new Pan-African movement intended to separate the continent from its imperial past. They intended to secure economic and diplomatic relations that could help present them as a united front in the world of international trade and politics. This eventually turned into the Organization of African Unity, but this reflected the interests of governments and not necessarily the people, while member nations continued to engage in border disputes amongst themselves. Nkrumah became more dictatorial in the 1960s as he disbanded other political parties and continued with his development schemes, while the economy lagged due to falling international cocoa prices. In 1966, while on a diplomatic trip to Vietnam, Nkrumah was deposed from leadership in Ghana, and he would die in exile without having fully fulfilled his dream of a strong Africa that could operate free of foreign interference on the world stage. Kenya's relationship and break with the British Empire looked much different than Ghana's, as it dealt with clashes between its white settlers and African nationalists, primarily dominated by the Kikuyu ethnic group, who were willing to resort to violent tactics targeting white settlers living in Kenya. Different ethnic groups banded together, and they were labeled by the British as Mau Mau, and they rebelled against the British. Their frustration stemmed from being moved off their productive lands during the 1930s and 40s, only to be replaced by white settlers on that land. A state of emergency was declared in 1952, and future president of Kenya, Jomo Kenyatta, was jailed soon thereafter. The fighting resulted in the deaths of anywhere from 11,000 to 90,000 Kenyans and 32 white settlers. However, international criticism forced the British to reevaluate their actions, and by 1959, the state of emergency was ended, clearing a path for eventual independence in 1963. The French colony of Algeria dealt with a similar situation as faced by Kenya, in spite of the fact that other French colonies throughout Africa were gaining their independence in a more peaceful manner. Many French settlers had been living in Algeria for decades, and they were very vocal regarding their opposition to independence, pressing the French government to hang on to the territory. Anti-French riots began in Algeria just as World War II in Europe was winding down, and a full-blown war for independence eventually broke out in 1954. The National Liberation Front, also known as the FLN, used guerrilla tactics to combat the French forces, and the French military responded by sending in hundreds of thousands of troops, including Algerians, to combat the Algerian insurgency. After years of intense fighting and the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Algerians, they eventually also achieved their independence in 1962. During the early 20th century, Algerians had been migrating to France in search of better economic opportunities in general, but this migration was increased as a result of Algerian independence, which created an increasingly distressed economy that could not provide opportunities for all Algerians. As a quick side note to all my soccer fans, some famous Algerians or children of Algerians who have played for the French national team include Zinedine Zidane, Karim Benzema, Samir Nasri, and Kylian Mbappe. In South Africa, since the Boer Wars, its whites had governed the territory with a purposeful intent to strip all black South Africans of any power or rights that would allow them to challenge the dominance of whites in their society. The World War II era had ushered in economic gains for all South Africans, and this led to its black citizens calling for increased political rights. These efforts were destroyed by the Afrikaner National Party, who developed the apartheid system, which was established to control and separate the black population of South Africa from the whites. Black South Africans had typically now lived in homelands that were determined by ethnicity, and they were separated from the white population. These race laws established jobs being available to only whites, allowed voting for citizens of color to only apply to their homelands, and allowed for the government to declare a state of emergency in response to any protest against South African laws. One such protest in which a state of emergency was declared took place in Sharpeville in 1960, where black protesters refused to carry identification passes. In response to these protests, there was a police shooting that resulted in the death of 69 blacks and another 180 wounded. In response to apartheid, the African National Congress began to advocate for a government that would represent all races of people in South Africa. Many of its leaders, including Nelson Mandela, were jailed for their political positions. Actions taken by the white government drew increasingly worldwide criticism, but nations like the United States were careful to critique the South African government out of fear of losing an ally in the fight against communism. It would not be until 1989, when F.W. de Klerk was elected, that the wrongs of apartheid began to be addressed. Mandela was released from prison in 1990, and together with de Klerk, they worked to figure out a post-apartheid future. A new constitution was drawn up in 1994, and Mandela was elected president of South Africa. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission began in 1996 and allowed for South Africans of all colors to confront their past in a direct manner, but without focusing on prosecuting criminals, even offering amnesty to culprits at times. This nonviolent transformation forced perpetrators to reckon with their past wrongdoings, but they were also potentially offered forgiveness for what they had done, so the country could attempt to collectively move beyond the horrors of its past. Though Latin America had achieved its independence in the early 19th century, it still faced problems relating to the legacy of colonial rule that privileged the descendants of the Creole elites above all others in society, while also wrestling with the relatively newer issue of neocolonialism, particularly in regards to involvement from the United States. In 1970, Chile elected its first socialist president, Salvador Allende, into power. However, Cold War geopolitics would have something to say about him staying in power for long. He nationalized industries throughout Chile, removing American businesses from the region, but shortly thereafter, the economy began to struggle as foreign investment dried up, and the United States in particular withdrew money from the nation in order to economically starve it, leading to production leveling off, which resulted in shortages and rising prices. Allende retained the support of many throughout Chile, but soon enough, a military coup d'etat led by General Augusto Pinochet overthrew Allende, who died in the process. Whether by suicide or by execution, it still remains unknown today. The United States had involved itself in Chile, working to undermine Allende's rule, but it has never been proven that it played a role in the overthrow of Allende. General Pinochet took the country over, and he sent it down a more conservative path, working to silence leftists while also opening Chile's economy to the free market. Over 100,000 political opponents were arrested, and most were tortured during the first few years of Pinochet's rule. Chile's economy proceeded to grow steadily throughout the 70s and 80s due to these free market reforms, but it is Pinochet's human rights record that will define his legacy. His presidency lasted until 1990, and by the early 2000s, he stood accused of being responsible for torturing over 35,000 political prisoners during his rule, not to mention his charges of murder and money laundering. He was set to go on trial for these charges, but he died in 2006 before ever having to atone for his crimes. In Central America, Nicaragua carried on their Somoza political dynasty that had killed Augusto Sandino back in the 1930s. The leader of Nicaragua in the 1960s and 1970s was a West Point graduate who had helped the U.S. in the Bay of Pigs invasion and was thus seen as a strong ally of the U.S. in the region. However, he had ruled with an iron fist by implementing martial law and banning all but two political parties from being able to run for election. In the 1960s, an opposition group known as the FSLN, nicknamed the Sandinistas, as named for the martyr of the 1930s, formed, intent on overthrowing Somoza and establishing a socialist Nicaragua. In a bloody struggle, the Sandinistas eventually overthrew Somoza by 1979. Part of what helped the FSLN to succeed were women soldiers who fought on the front lines alongside of the Sandinistas. What also helped were the advocates within the Catholic Church for what was called liberation theology. Liberation theology sought to unite the principles of socialism with Catholicism and was highly controversial. Some Catholics believed socialism reflected the message of God, while others could not reconcile the anti-religious beliefs of Marxism with their own faith. Regardless of divisions, by the end of the conflict, many Catholics had come to embrace the socialist beliefs of the Sandinistas. However, it would not go smoothly for Nicaragua as efforts continued to undermine their new government. Counter-revolutionary groups known as the Contras worked to fight against the Sandinistas. These Contras were being financed and equipped by the United States of America during Ronald Reagan's administration. As this happened, the Sandinistas grew closer and closer to the Soviet Union and Cuba. The American government continued to pour money and weapons into the region, working to prevent the spread of communism in their own backyard. However, the American public had grown tired of these actions, and it was outlawed to continue financing anti-communist efforts in Nicaragua. At the same time, the head of the National Security Council in America was selling weapons to Iran in the hopes that American prisoners there would be released, effectively negotiating with a nation that sponsored terrorism. The money raised from the sale of weapons was used to fund the Contras in Nicaragua. News of this covert operation broke into the American newsstream in 1986, and the Iran-Contra scandal immediately became front-page news. This scandal led to the dismissal of several American officials and damaged the credibility of Reagan with the American public. For today's Complicating the Narrative, I wanted to talk about a news story that I found from PRI that talks about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the impact of his I Have a Dream speech on the world, not just the United States. So the article suggests that Dr. King's speech should not only be seen as the spark that led to the push for racial equality, but it should also be seen as a moment that threatened to do significant damage to America's reputation in foreign relations. Considering this speech in the broader context of the Cold War means that an audience of Africans, Asians, and Latin Americans, people who had played a subservient role to white people as a result of imperialism from the past, might identify with King's struggle against American injustices as opposed to identifying with the liberty and democracy America claimed to stand for. If America was to capture the hearts and minds of newly independent countries, it needed to do right by its African-American citizens and grant them the civil rights they demanded. The Soviet Union had used instances of American racism and harsh treatment of African-Americans as a propaganda tool in an attempt to discredit the values Americans claimed to represent. The Kennedy administration, fully aware of the potential value that this event had for Soviet propaganda, worked to portray King's speech as an opportunity of Americans voicing their hopes and desires in a peaceful manner, representing all that is right and good about American society. I particularly like the quote from the author Calvin Sims that reads, quote, "What is often forgotten is that King's speech was at its core not a dream of what America could be, but rather an indictment of what America was, a country that had failed to live up to its founding principles of equality. In the first half of the speech, King is searing in his criticism, saying, 'It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check that has come back marked insufficient funds,'" end quote. However, I particularly like what Sims has to say about his experiences when he was a journalist serving briefly in North Korea, and he was asked by the locals there, "Why is America so racist?" And this was his response, quote, "My response was always that America is far less racist than most countries, but it suffers from a long-standing image of racism due to its legacy of slavery and the great attention Americans place on addressing it. incidents of racism are taken more seriously in the United States than anywhere else. The news media reports on them. Political leaders denounce them. Perpetrators are prosecuted. There are protests and boycotts, public apologies, and promises to do better. America remains the world standard bearer for equality, and the world is watching. End quote. America worked hard to address the civil rights issue, not only because of the demand its own citizens were placing on the government, but the pressure was also coming externally, as newly independent people from around the world looked on as it decided what camp to fall in line with, as the Cold War divided the vast majority of the world into one of two ideological camps. America is and always has been shaped by internal and external pressures. American history is always world history. Today's document is focus comes from Ho Chi Minh's Proclamation of Independence of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam from September 2, 1945. Here's the excerpt that I want to read to you. Quote, "All men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of the French Revolution, made in 1871, on the rights of man and citizen, also states, all men are born free and with equal rights, and must always remain free and have equal rights. Those are unalienable truths. Nevertheless, for more than 80 years, the French imperialists, abusing the standard of liberty, equality, and fraternity, have violated our fatherland and oppressed our fellow citizens. They have acted contrary to the ideals of humanity and justice. For these reasons, we solemnly declare to the world that Vietnam has a right to be free and an independent country, and in fact is so already. The entire Vietnamese people are determined to mobilize all their physical and mental strength to sacrifice their lives and property in order to safeguard their independence and liberty." End quote. I'd like to contextualize this speech excerpt from Ho Chi Minh and discuss the intended audience as well. So this speech was delivered on September 2, 1945, which was the same exact day the Japanese signed the Instrument of Surrender documents, ending World War II in the Pacific. At this moment, the Vietnamese announced their break from the French rule, which you and I know would take much longer to realize than a matter of days in 1945. However, considering the context of the moment, the point in time when wars against imperial expansion have been fought and won by the Allied powers, it makes sense why Ho Chi Minh is seizing this exact moment to voice his and his people's desire for independence. Also, pay attention to the language and what he mentions, and you'll realize the intended audience of this document stretches well past the people of Vietnam. Ho Chi Minh is attempting to appeal not only to his fellow countrymen, but also the French imperial powers and the United States of America, who could have been an ally in the Vietnamese cause for independence. This explains why he makes reference to not only the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen, but also America's Declaration of Independence. He borrows their language because he wants the powers of the West to realize their historical struggle is now Vietnam's struggle, and in that sense they share a common sense of brotherhood. As you know, of course, he would not win the favor with the West, as his communist government of North Vietnam was fought against by both the French and the Americans in the ensuing decades. But this is exactly what I love about this historical moment in time. Not only do we continue to see increased levels of global interconnectivity, but we also see the long reach of history continue to stir the pot in the present day, and Ho Chi Minh's words reflect that exact point. So quick recommendation for you today, so I can wrap this up in under 40 minutes, the longest one ever, I know. This is for NPR's Throughline, which is a new podcast that came out recently. And what it does is it seeks to kind of peel back the historical layers that are underneath the major news stories of our contemporary world. In particular, I used some excerpts from the episode on the CIA coup of Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953 for this particular episode. Definitely give it a check, though, because episodes are like 35-ish minutes long. They're really well-researched, they're really well-produced, and they're well-delivered as well. So check it out. So that's it. All done. That was actually not as long as Evan thought it was going to be, even though it was the longest one ever. So until next time, which will be, believe it or not, our last time, I'll talk to you soon. Take care, everyone.